The history that they wrote was a history that glorified the Arians. In fact, there's a quote in The League of the Haudenosaunee by Morgan, in which he states flat out, in this, the founding book for anthropology, that the Aryan race, obviously, are the civilized people of the world, and because they've conquered everybody. And then the historians that came along were not looking for non-Western ancestors for their thinking or their traditions. So I would say this was the case, and I want to say this because we're going to go on and on from here to look at how history went. It was the case that those things that happened in history which were inconvenient became lost, and that I would have said that had the Indians had a major role in the formation of the democratic tradition, that the Aryan model of history that dominated the American academia from about 1850 to about 1950, that trend of history would have airbrushed the Indians out of, if the Indians had been in there in the first place. Okay, if they had been there, they'd have got airbrushed out. And I really strongly recommend to people to look at Bernal's book. It's the first truly critical view of the tradition of historiography and its historical relations as something that came out of Göttingen University and all of those places in Germany where chairs were given to people for the specific purpose of celebrating and aggrandizing the Caucasian race as the dominant race of the world. And I think that any history, as Bernal says in his book, any history that's built on the model needs to be reevaluated. But look at American history is all built, almost all of it built on that model, except for the revisionists, the historians of the 20th century. It's almost all built on that model. Second, I say that the things that were important that we needed to know about how things got to be the way they are, generally speaking, are missing from the record. What we have is a record that seeks, generally speaking, has sought to make the way things happen explainable as either positivist kind of determinism, or as something that would have happened in any case, or as something that was wonderful that it did happen, and something that was a product of a progressive thing that's been happening over the centuries. And so it has been proposed to us that all of the misery and starvation and anguish and stuff that peoples have suffered over the centuries has been a natural process of history and something that we can celebrate. In fact, in a few years, we are going to be called upon to celebrate the arrival of Columbus to the American shores. As we've been called upon to celebrate many, what I think was a biological and natural disaster of the first magnitude, we're going to be called to celebrate that one. So let me for a little while retell. Let me retell what happened in the beginning, and then let's see if anybody believes that the Indians had anything to do. Let me just tell a little story of history about what I say happened, and I'll give some books to celebrate my version. I say the history of America doesn't start in 1492. It starts in 1366, when a Portuguese sailor named Lanzarote found an island in what is the Canary Islands called Lanzarote Island, and went back and reported it. Lanzarote, while the Canary Islands, at the time of their discovery, were peopled by people called the Gaunches. And the Gaunches were about 80,000 strong, people living in the Canary Islands who were probably originally North African in descent, who had migrated to the Canary Islands by boat and had lost the ability to do navigation, had been discovered almost undoubtedly by the Phoenicians and forgotten for 2,000 years and rediscovered by the Portuguese. Not long after that, Portuguese sailors also discovered Madeiras Island in the Azores. And immediately from that point of view, processes started happening. The announcement of in the Azores, they found unoccupied islands. And in the Canaries, they found occupied islands. In the Azores, what happened was that the Portuguese gave permission for colonists to go to the Azores and to begin colonizing those islands. And indeed, they did. In the 1450s, colonists began arriving there. Madeiras Island was the first one that they arrived at. It was completely covered by forest, an island unpopulated. There was no evidence on it of any prehistoric peoples had ever lived on it. It was indeed a virgin island. When they arrived there, they found that they couldn't live on it. They solved that problem in short order. The first colonists, the first year there, burned the island to the ground, burned everything on the island to the ground. They were so successful at that that today we have no idea what species of plants, trees, bugs, salamanders, birds, or whatever might have lived there. Burned it all down. They then set out to find a use for the island. And the use that they evolved to was to make the island into a sugar plantation. The sugar plantation, in fact, was so successful that by the turn of, by around 1480s, Madeira's island was the world's largest exporter of sugar products to Europe, largest exporter of sugar products to any place. They built a mill there and so forth. But what had happened is Madeira's island had been turned into a sugar plantation, but there was no labor to do that. They brought in colonists, but there wasn't a lot of ability to generate colonists to come into to Madeira's island to work the sugar plantations. And besides, they needed cheaper labor than they were able to get off the mainland. In or around 1402, the first Spanish, and at that time Spanish and French, but this has to do with momentary political alliances that went on, the first landings of European soldiers happened at Lanzarote and on the Canary Islands. And between 1402 and 1496, the Canary Islands were the subject of increasing Spanish, especially, conquistador pressure on the Gaunches. The Gaunches, which I said in the beginning were 80,000 strong, were reduced by 1496. 1496 was the last battle. The reason for the Battle of the Canaries was to find slaves to take to Madeira's Island to run the sugar plantations. It was kind of interesting that if you look into history, Columbus's father-in-law, the father of Columbus's wife, was a governor of one of those islands. And Columbus himself made his money before his famous voyage, made his money bringing slaves to the island. By Columbus's time, they had discovered that the slaves who made the best slaves for this purpose were black slaves from Africa. So the black slave trade had already started. It had started to provide labor for Madeira's island. There's a wonderful quote in a book called Ecological Imperialism, The Biological Expansion of Europe by Alfred W. Crosby, and 900 to 1900, in which he describes that what happened in the Canary Islands was that the long period of isolation from other peoples on the mainland, and especially from the diseases that were known to go through European, African, Asian populations, the long period of that isolation had left the Gaunches without very much resistance to them. So the Gaunches fell victim as much to smallpox, chickenpox, whooping cough, and various other disorders like that, as much as they did to the military invasion. On the last day of the last battle, the Spanish were able to march into the Gaunch camp unopposed. Everybody had died, pretty much everybody, all but a few had died the night before as a result of this. Today, it's argued that there are some descendants in the Azores of the Gaunches, but for all practical purposes, we don't even know exactly what they looked like, and there's no memory of their language, nothing of their culture. They were exterminated from the face of the earth. In Crosby's book, though, there's a wonderful quote in which he says that the Gaunches were the first line of defense in a series of behind that line, behind them, We're waiting, the Iroquois, the Navajo, all the other peoples of the Western Hemisphere. Because he says the Gaunches were the first colonized people, colonized and exterminated. So when Christopher Columbus sailed his boat west, we cannot argue that he knew that he would find land. But I think it's pretty clear we could tell from the example of Madeira's Island what would happen if we found land and people. The Spanish had already learned that you could make profits through slavery, through a colonization of land that was developed for export crops. And they had already develop their culture in that direction. The reason that Columbus was given the gold to do, or the money to build the ships, to do the thing to go west, was not because people were seeking another route to the Indies. It was essentially because people were after money. And we were off and running. The modern era is well dated at 1500, about 1500, the modern world, because the modern world is about making money in this fashion. But at any rate, so this is what happens next. When we arrive in the Americas, one of the big questions that I always had about how come things happened the way they were was that when you look at the civilizations of Mexico and you look at the Spanish, you would assume that the Spanish and the Mexicans would be a pretty good match. Looking at Montezuma's people, a highly militaristic society, a well-established civilization, lots of people, lots of wealth, and a hierarchy that looks more hierarchical than just about any other Indians that you can think of. Maybe the Incas are more hierarchical. But you have here what looks like a stubborn, tough, and also brutal at times, militaristic society. It's always been amazing to me that the Spanish could have made it and conquered Mexico in the years they did, because I would have thought, just looking at the numbers and the stuff, that they would meet their match there. These were not easily, you know, like on the Caribbean, you had, you know, kind of like peaceful sort of hanging around the beach kind of Indians that, you know, when you got to Mexico, I mean, you had some serious, you know, some serious Indians, you know. So what happened in there, in Mexico? I have another book that I think does the best job of explaining it that I've ever seen done. It's a book that speaks to the issue of how come the Mexican army collapsed at the critical moment in history. When history should have probably had the first Mexican army eaten up by the Aztecs. They should have eaten them up overnight, and they didn't. The Spanish army. The book is called The Columbian Exchange, Biological and Cultural Consequences of 1492, and it's also by Alfred Crosby. And what it speaks to is what happened when the same diseases that wiped out the Gaunches arrived in America, they wiped out the Indians. And it tells stories of places where whole villages disappeared, where one pass of smallpox wiped out two-thirds of an army, and so forth. A very powerful, I think, argument. And also some explanations. There's another book that describes why this could have been. He really goes back, way back into the origins of European history for the explanation. And it's a classic work, too, by the way. It's a book by William H. McNeil. It's called Plagues and Peoples. And what he describes is the origins in Western civilization of all of these epidemic diseases. He says that it came because early European civilizations, we're thinking here about stuff that started in Mesopotamia like 5,000 years ago, that early on they had a tendency to bring animals and birds and stuff into the house, that they lived with cows and pigs and goats and chickens and ducks and various other creatures. And that humans and animals exchanged diseases just as we do today. That smallpox and cowpox are a disease that went back and forth between humans and cows and so on and so forth, and a various number of diseases did this. Today the disease that does that goes between birds and humans is influenza. But that humans and animals exchange disease, and that humans, over long periods of time, he said, those diseases got stronger and stronger, but the number of survivors from each round of that also got stronger. The survivors got stronger and stronger. They got more and more immune. So that by the time these diseases found their way to non-Western populations, the diseases were really poised. The diseases were really well advanced in their ability to kill people. And of course, those people had no experience with them at all. So I think McNeil really gives us a foundation for a way to think about how disease affects political history, but I also think that Crosby does a lot to explain specifics about how that history rolled out. Crosby's also, he speaks to issues about what went on in New Zealand. He talks about how maritime technology really evolved and made it possible for people to cross the oceans and stuff, all of which turns out to be very interesting when we look at history, because what we're going to see next is that we have three groups in America that are going to affect the Indians. In the broadest sense, the three most powerful groups are going to be the Spanish, the French, and the English. Oh, yeah, I know the Portuguese were here, the Swedes, and everybody else. But those three kind of dominate the stage of history. And we'll dominate the stage of history as it affects our lives, I believe. The next little piece I want to drop back and talk about is about, well, first of all, let me finish this piece about the Spanish. Why did the Spanish not become the source of democratic thinking? Is a good question, right? I mean, you know, if we're going to say now we're working on a theory that somehow this came from somewhere, and we look at the Spanish conquest of the Americas, we have two dominant themes. One dominant theme was that the Spanish way of doing conquest didn't involve a lot of conversation between them and the Indians. I think the second one is that the Spanish just really, we're not talking here about a population that comes to immigrate. Even when the Spanish are here, they're really in New Spain. When the Spanish come to recreate Madeiras. The Spanish come to run encomiendas. The Spanish come as conquerors. They don't even talk to Indians. In fact, to this day, in much of Latin America, they don't talk to the Indians. So you had that, with the Spanish, you had this incredible standoffish sort of, and also powerful, powerful racism. If you don't believe in the racism, I offer you to read a book called Aristotle and the American Indians by Lewis Hankey, which recounts the Valladolid debates of 1541 and looks at the psychology of the people who are arguing the debate. I mean, Sepulveda argues basically that the Indians aren't really human beings, and Las Casas argues that they are human beings and they probably could become good Catholics, and if we could, we could get taxes out of them, and he goes on and on to say that we should save them. But Sepulveda really makes the argument that Indians ought to be bowled out of the way, and they're just beasts of burden. The next one, though, that I want people to find out about is, because we're living in an English-speaking sort of place, right around 1565, the English were watching all of this stuff. To get to America, by the way, the reason you don't have any English settlements over here until the early part of the 17th century is because the Spanish were running the waterways, right? We're in a period of time when to get to the Americas from Europe, you must come by wind. And the wind that brings you to America from Europe takes you south to the Azores. And you take a right and across the ocean. To get back, you got to go north and then come across the ocean. That's the only way to do it, if you want to do it with wind power. So this creates a problem. The Spanish have pretty good grip on who gets to go down to the Azores in turn. And they're not letting anybody come, you know. That's why we don't. So the English are sitting there, and they're pretty upset. I mean, they had said, in fact, there were guys who had worked with the Spanish in the Azores, and also the English are one of the big markets for this sugar. But at any rate, the English are at home are thinking, you know, we got to go someplace, and we got to have our own empire, and we got to find somebody we can do to the Indians, like to the Indians, what the Spanish did to the Indians. So they start selling stock in London. On a colonization conquest idea. And the place that they planned their colonization and conquest is to go to Ireland, where there's supposed to be wood and land and all this stuff. And they'll get colonists in England to move up to Ireland, and then they'll conquer Ireland. And they'll get all the benefits of colonization, and they'll be able to get what they need. And they get to Ireland. Of course, in Ireland, you have a people who look a lot like the English do and are nominally Christians, they're Catholics. And so they get up there, and you know, according to feudal law, if you're Christians aren't supposed to beat on other Christians unless they have real good reason. And you're not supposed to, you know, do this stuff. And the plan was basically to go there and steal their land and cut down their wood and pay for this thing with their wood. And pretty soon, when the English are up there, they make an amazing discovery among the Irish. They find out that the Irish are not really Christians. It's like they're not civilized. They're not even human. In fact, they're probably cannibals. And all this propaganda comes back to England to denigrate the Irish so that things can be done to the Irish that need to be done in order to have colonization and steal their land and do this other stuff. So we have the second thing of a very brutal conquest of English armies marching into Ireland, massacring whole villages, butchering everybody they can catch, driving them off their land, bringing new colonists in here. This is all going on at about the same time that we remember the Spanish Armada, when the Spanish finally said, we've had enough of this Captain Blood and Earl Flynn coming down here and robbing our boats. So the Irish, the Spanish Armada sails about 1588, while the The conquest of Ireland is still in process. A very interesting book that I thought really takes a little bit of finding to get a citation for. It's called The Elizabethan Conquest of Ireland, a Pattern Established 1565 to 76 by Nicholas P. Canny. Interesting because when we get to New England and we want to study what happened in New England with the Indians, we're going to find out that they had a lot of practice on the Irish, that the same explanations of why you're going to take the land and who the Indians were, cannibalism, that they don't really have control of the land, they don't really live here, they're probably nomadic anyway. But with the Indians, they were the wrong color and had the wrong religion, didn't speak the right language, blah, 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 went on and on, and that's why we can take their land. So the Elizabethan conquest sets the stage for what's going to happen next. And what's going to happen next in the story that we're looking at, fundamentally, is that you're going to have two themes are going to be transported from England. Theme number one is going to be the thrust of what was already in place and moving along at a fast rate by the time 1600 comes, and that was the enclosure system in England. In England, it had been determined, the only place in the world that this originates, as far as I can tell, is England. It had been determined by people who had money that having peasants and people living on your land isn't the most profitable way to hold land. So they found that if they kick the peasants off and they put sheep on there, they make more money on a piece of land with the peasants off than with the peasants on. And the enclosure system is a system about kicking people off and coming up with excuses in the law to kick people off the land so that you can use it for better investment purposes. So in England, you had two things arriving in one package with the English. In New England, you had this tradition of clearing the land of people who are already on it so it can be put to uses to make money, which the Spanish never had that. And then the other thing that you had was this tradition of racism, if you would. All the excuses why we can deny somebody the right to their land, all the reasons why we can attack them and kill them, all this other stuff was already well practiced, well figured out, all worked out when the English arrived in what they call New England. An absolutely wonderful book to read, to look at this, is a book by William Cronin, and it's called Changes in the Land, in which he describes the ecological change brought by people who come with new animals, new weeds, new plants, new diseases, new thinking, new ways of bounding the land, ways of disinheriting the Indian or disenfranchising him, getting rid of him, and the psychology that came with all of this stuff. I think very, very interesting reading. I highly recommend Changes in the Land, one of the best books I think that was written in 1983. So this was all in place, this was all coming, but another piece that happened I think really deserves some attention. You know what, if I was to pick what's wrong with American historians and the way they present history, it's that to them it seems as though history ends at the water. You know, it's as if the boats came this way and landed, they never went back, you know. And if we talk American history, you wait till the guy got off the boat, then we start getting his story from here. And if he goes back, we forget, we wait, we don't hear from him again until he gets back again. And I think at least the Europeans, at least when you go to European historians, at least they have a sense that, hey, they started here and they moved over there, but their problem is once they get on shore over here, the Europeans go back. But if we could imagine now that we have permission to bridge both things, that these people came from over there to here, then they went from here back over there, and then they came back again, back and forth. Some people made this 20 times. And when they went back, they took things with them. And when they came over here, they brought things with them. And then when they went back, so there was a dynamic going on. In a way, the most interesting country of the bunch is in France. And because of what happened in France, as much as what happened here. Because first of all, you have to understand, during a good piece of this early history, what we had was King Henry V of England over there beating up on the French during a lot of this period, carrying on a war, which, by the way, tells us a lot about the existing political structure thinking in Europe. Europe was really characterized by feudal violence during this period of time, people asserting their claim to the crown based on their genetics, and on dubious claims at best, and basically going to war for no other palpable reason than that they should be the duchy of this or the king of that or whatever. So there was this constant thing going on. England invaded France, and back then England did invade France in the beginning of the 15th century, and stayed there for quite a while. In fact, the French still hated their guts, you know, 150 years later for that. While this was going on, though, in France, what happens let's say in the early 1600s, although this is building, is that in France there's a revolution that goes on, and it's interesting. Have to dig around to find this. There was a literary revolution. People were learning how to read, and they were running printing presses, making books, and there was the most literate society in Europe by the 17th century was in France. More people per thousand could read, and more people did, and people bought books and this and that, the other thing, which going to have powerful, powerful implications for world history, believe it or not. The French arrive in America kind of a blend of the Spanish and English. Not really conquistadors, they'd like to be occasionally, but every time they try it, something goes wrong. And kind of moving in here, bring a lot of the church with them, but the French church has a kind of peculiarity to it, and it has a heretical tradition in the French church. The French church occasionally has people who decide that they're really going to try to follow the life of Jesus, which is the most heretical idea in the Christian world. At any rate, every once in a while they come up, they get all pious and they give up material stuff, and then they have some crowd that goes barefoot. The crew that did that were the Jesuits in North America, and when they first arrived around, 1613 or something like that. When they first arrived, they're here, and they're really going to live the life of Jesus and bring the good word to the Indians and bring them out of the night and this and that. And they get to the Indians, and they look at the Indians, and then the Jesuit relations, the Jesuits are writing down, we came here to bring God's word to the Indians. But we're getting kind of confused because the Indians, they don't lie, they don't cheat, they don't steal, they don't do this, they don't do that. In fact, they probably live more like Jesus than we do. And then there's this other thing they notice. They say, if anybody's hungry, everybody's hungry. If anybody's got anything to eat, everybody's got something to eat. And on, they look at the Indians, and then the Spanish had first posited the idea that that the Indians were sort of people made of nature. The French looked at that, and they said, well, maybe people who come out of nature are blessed or something. And for the first time, there arrived in Europe a kind of regular thing coming through the Jesuit relations, that pile of writings that became like the bestsellers of National Geographic of France of the 17th century, that also became kind of the first time that raised questions that people had never dared ask before. Because what the implications of the Indian living in this sort of semi-paradise, and of him being a just human being, and of him being a nice, likable guy, was completely contradictory to what they had been expecting if a people lived in some consort with nature. Nature was supposed to produce a brute, and the brute of nature was being held down by the services of the state, which provided you with an army and protection and jails and gallows and all those things that are necessary to keep the brute in line. And here was somebody who didn't have that stuff. Didn't have that stuff, didn't lie, didn't cheat, didn't do anything they were supposed to do if you didn't have that stuff. And it began to raise the kinds of questions that needed to be raised that are going to form the foundation for the intellectual movement that will someday become the French Revolution. So in the French, we have that. And we also have the other thing in the French, too. We have the adventurers in the French. These guys who came over here and saw what they saw and wrote home and said, here's what I saw. Among whom, by the way, was a fellow by the name of the Baron de Lahontan, whose writings appear in French in 1693 and in English in 1703, and who wrote, I think it was called New Voyages to North America, two volumes, in which he describes the beavers, the this, the that. But in his writings, he has this one set of writings in which he describes a fellow he calls Adelio, which sounds suspiciously like a real Iroquois name. And he talks about this guy in his conversations with him as though he's a real person. It is widely believed, I think academically provable, that he was not. He was a stylized person. He was a composition put together by Lahontan to make his point. And I have no doubt that the conversations are tinged with Lahontan's own personal views, but his criticism of Western legal system is as good as anything we'll find into the 20th century. It is really excellent. When he says what's wrong with the French court system, you can read that today and see things that make sense. He goes after everything. Lahontan attacks the idea of the French ideas of religion. He makes fun of the French. The French say, you should learn to be civilized like we are. And at one point, Adelio says to Lahontan, he says, you're not civilized. He says, you people act like beavers. The only person who's free in all of your country is the king. He's the only one that has any freedom. He says, everybody else has to do what he says or else. And Lahontan's opening, the opening books to Lahontan says that the idea of the validity and the sanctity of the individual's human spirit is an idea that the Indians have taught to us. And he goes on to, at some length, describing what that would be. At any rate, for 50 years, now people are going to argue about whether Lahontan was a good academic or what, but for 50 years after his book came out, Lahontan was read by people as a major source of what the personality and character of the Indians was. And I think really informed the West a lot about a whole bunch of radical ideas that you would have probably had your head chopped off if Lahontan had said it was his idea, but he could put those ideas in the mouth of an Indian guy and get away with it. So this was the way things were. And the French, of course, provide us with the intellectual tradition that the Americans find in Europe. But the intellectual tradition that the Americans find in Europe, I say, was very heavily influenced by the American Indians, extremely by their experience with the Indians, by the Indians themselves, by a whole topic of conversation that had there not been Indians, this topic would never have arisen. Just to get back to our German historians for a moment, two things that the Germans hated in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, 60s, beyond all else. They hated the Semitics. The Semitics were, they perceived the Semitics to be the devil and all that stuff. So it was a period of extreme anti-Semitism in Europe. And to be a German academic, you had to join that.